The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football, with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code media at FanDuel.com to play a risk-free tournament for up to $10. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the smartest way to buy sell tickets for your favorite sports teams. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code media for $20 off your first purchase.
I consider myself an aggressive reporter, and there are a lot of those out there. I'm going to get my scoop somehow. I'm going to get my story somehow. I'm going to get my exclusive somehow. So if I got to work around you, maneuver, or whatever, I'm going to get it. And at the end of the day, when I do get it, and you've been trying to restrict me all this time, it's definitely not going to come out the way that you intended because you're trying to block my access. I see so many reporters, man. They go up to a player I've never even spoke to him before. Just come up and ask them a question that, you know, that the player's mom wouldn't even ask him. I'm like, that's not going to get you anywhere. You know what I mean? If anything, the player is going to remember your face forever. He's not going to give you anything. So it's all about your approach, man. It's all about how you talk and how you maneuver.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we speak with interesting members of the sports media. My name is Richard Deitch. I'm your host. My producer is Alan Kim. And our guest this week is Chris Haynes. He is the Cavaliers beat reporter and NBA insider for Cleveland.com and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He previously worked in Portland for Comcast Sportsnet, covering the Trailblazers. Chris, obviously being a beat reporter and one of the prominent voices in Cleveland on the Cavaliers, has a fascinating job because he is essentially following LeBron James around, arguably the most popular athlete in this country and certainly one of the great athletes of our generation. He's following him around on a daily basis, and that's an interesting news job. One of the reasons I wanted to have Chris on, in addition to the fact that I think he has an interesting job, is that he recently wrote a really interesting first-person piece on his greatest regret and why LeBron James on Tamir Rice requires more examining than one might realize. LeBron was criticized for not being, I think, more prominent in giving an opinion about that case. And then Chris wrote just an amazing first-person piece about being racially profiled in Portland, eventually being exonerated in the court system there, and just how that reflected and his own beliefs in what LeBron did or did not say. So when I read that piece, I really wanted to have Chris on the podcast. I've talked to him before about covering the Cavs. He's a really bright guy and really good at what he does. So I was psyched that he decided to come on. All right. Thank you very much for listening to the previous podcast that we've done, from Sage Deal to Bob McKenzie to Diana Moskovitz to Gus Johnson, who was last week's. And without any further ado, let's bring on Chris Haynes of Cleveland.com and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Okay, as promised, we bring in Chris Haynes, who is in Cleveland and making some time for us prior to him heading out to the airport to fly to Washington, D.C., where he'll be covering, I assume, the Cavs and the Wizards. Chris, thank you very much for joining the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Rich, thanks for having me, my guy.
You got it. Chris, you know, this is a process. We're going to get to a lot of things here, but this, at its core, is a kind of a process podcast because the guests that we have on, people are really interested in what you do and how you do it. So I want to start with, can you take me through what a game day is like from you, from the time you get up to whatever kind of preparation you're doing to covering the game and then to filing your story after the game, and go as long as you need?
Yeah, well, you know, I wake up about 6 in the morning and I get a preview up for that night's game. Basically, that's just a rundown of the starting lineups. Pretty simple, nothing too difficult. Basically, of a rundown of the starting lineups, the kind of the trends over the last 10 games from both teams. You know, basically looking at some of the matchups, what they've done prior, you know, throughout the season, head to head, that is. From there, shoot around is when the, you know, the teams have a little light practice before the game. That's usually around 10 or so in the morning. So you go there, wait for the players to be available after shoot around, or if it's on the road, Cavs like to have availability before shoot around. So get what you need as far as player interviews and whatnot. And usually you're talking to players to kind of set the theme and the tone of that tonight's game. And so usually players are focused on that game. They don't want to speak outside of that day. And so then after that, gather up the quotes, formulate your story idea, and, you know, get a post or two up around 11:30, 12, and that kind of sets the agenda for the night's game. And then you have pregame availability where coaches and players are available about an hour and a half before the game starts. So coach speaks, see what he has to say. If there's anything different that he said, you know, at that time, opposed to what, you know, what was said at shoot around, kind of gauging what, you know, the tone of him, then the players as well, go to the players and talk. And depending on what comes out of that, you might have to do another post or two coming from pregame. And that's right before the game starts around 7 or 7:30. And then throughout the game, you know, this is funny because, you know, a lot of old school journalists, you know, Twitter wasn't around right back then. And so they could really, you know, focus on the game a lot more so than you can now. Because now it's all about tweeting out, you know, what just happened in real time. And it takes you away from the game a lot. You know, this is my fifth year covering the league, so I kind of came up in the Twitter era, so this is all I know. But I definitely can understand the frustration with some guys that it takes them off of, you know, doing quality work on their game stories. Because for a lot of us, depending on, well, me in particular, I have to file a game story right at the buzzer. And then after post-game locker room availability is over, then I, you know, write a story or two after that. And so Twitter is definitely something that it took a lot of people time to get accustomed to learn how to use it. I often say this, you know, when fans, they come to me and say, man, you get to watch all the games, man. How's that fun doing your job? And I tell them, I'm like, look, you probably watching more of the game than I am. You know, I'm so busy, you know, tweeting and writing because I have to have a story at the buzzer. So that's pretty much my routine daily agenda on game nights.
That's interesting. And that's a lot of work. One of the things that you brought up at the end there, Twitter, obviously, you know, there is a mandate essentially at pretty much every news organization that they want you to be involved in social media because, and smartly so, it's a way to connect with your audience and to gain, you know, to gain, whether it's listeners or readers or viewers, whatever medium you're in. What has Cleveland.com and the Cleveland Plain Dealer, this would be interesting to me, specifically asked you about social media? Do they sort of mandate it, Chris, where they say, we want you to tweet every night? Or is this something that you, as the beat reporter, have just decided to do because of the value, because you know that your readers out there want things in real time?
Yeah, they haven't, you know, they haven't really urged. I think when I first started, this is my second year covering the Cavaliers and with the Plain Dealer. When I first got on, obviously they, you know, they urge you to have a Twitter presence, let people know where you're at, so people know that, hey, you're here, you're in Washington, you're in Cleveland, you know, you're really following the team. So from that standpoint, they haven't really, you know, followed my, not going to say follow my tweets, but they haven't really, you know, just consistently asked me or demanded that I tweet constantly. Me personally, you know, if you look at my tweets, I tweet sometimes during the game, but me, for my own personal, I think each beat reporter or writer should have their own personal branding. And I mean branding as in Twitter. Like, I break a lot of news on my beat. And so whenever I tweet, I want it to be relevant. I want it to be when they see Crispy Haynes tweet something, they know, hey, let's go to this story. Let's find out what he's talking about now. Let's find out what tidbit is in the story now. And so I'm not, you know, some people just tweet constantly throughout a game, 25 times throughout the game. I don't do that. I may tweet 3 or 4 times if I see something, or if I spot something, or, you know, obviously if there's a major injury you need to update people about. So I go about it that way. And my company really hasn't, you know, got on me about that. I just feel like, you know, instead of flooding my Twitter account with a lot of little tidbits of Cavs on a 10-0 run, because, you know, things change in the game. I mean, the tweet that you put out 2 minutes ago could be irrelevant 2-3 minutes later.
Right.
So whatever I tweet out, I try to make it relevant to where if you go back and look at my Twitter timeline tomorrow, you can go back and still learn some things, you know, off my yesterday's tweet. So that's how I tend to go about it.
How media accessible are the Cavs as an organization?
Much better this year. Much better. I have to admit that I was highly disappointed coming into my first year covering the Cavaliers. You know, guys were not made available when they were supposed to. You know, they just, you know, I think the players, for the most part, they got accustomed to not having to adhere by the media availability guidelines of the league, and nobody really pressed them on it. Nobody really told them or held them accountable. I was very disappointed last year. You would ask me last year, I would have said the Cavs were probably at the bottom 5 of the league as far as availability. And with that being said, even going back to last year, LeBron James is one of the most media available players in the league. And he's, you know, the biggest superstar that we have in this game. He would speak, he would come over and speak when he didn't even have to. You know, sometimes when the Cavs open up the practice facility for us to go in, LeBron's already at the, at the spot where we're supposed to interview him at. So that was a pleasant surprise. I've really been impressed by LeBron James's professionalism, how he interacts with the media members, and the responsibility that he has. Others who, you know, came up in that organization, like, you know, Oklahoma City Thunder, New York Knicks. I think if you come up under that organization, like you're drafted by those teams, you get accustomed to how things are run. And I personally, this is my own personal opinion, but I think smaller market teams like Oklahoma City or maybe, you know, Cleveland, I think it was ran that way with their players because they're a small market team. Like free agency wise, you're not going to attract free agents to Cleveland by looking at the downtown, looking at the skyline, looking at the main attractions. But what you can say, or what you can do, is say, well, hey, we can alleviate some of your responsibilities. We'll make sure you take care of you and do things that way. So it can be a more player friendly environment. I think that has been the case, but you know, a lot of local media members here in Cleveland, me, Dave McMenamin, Joe Varden, Jason Lloyd, you know, we got on the Cavs about that all last year, and it's been night and day compared to last year to this year.
That's interesting. In terms of LeBron's accessibility, I think people would really find this interesting because you're around him on a day-to-day basis. What kind of time does he give the local press corps on a daily basis, on a daily/weekly basis?
He's really accessible. I mean, he knows pretty much all the local beat guys by their first name. It's to the point where you can say if you really need a story idea from him, you need like a quick one-on-one with him. You know, he'll gauge, want to know what you want to talk about, but 90% of the time he'll grant it. You know, he'll give you time for about, you know, he'll give you another 5 minutes, maybe even 10 minutes. He's that cool about it, you know, but he's also, you know, as any superstar athlete, you know, they're concerned about the image, you know, the image they're going to portray. So if they're going to grant this access, they want to obviously know what the question is going to pertain to. So he does ask his questions. But like I said, for the most part, man, I was surprised, man. I really was surprised. He jokes around with you. He's cool. And I came from that type of environment where in Portland, I covered the Portland Trailblazers 4 years prior.
Right.
And that was my first beat. And so I was used to guys coming over, they'll talk to the media press. And then afterwards, you know, I would sit there and BS with Damian Lillard, Brandon Roy, LaMarcus, and we would just talk on a human level. And, you know, he find out how many kids I got. You know, we just bond, just talk as humans. And when I came over to the Cavs last year, totally different. The PR staff basically walked the players over to the, you know, the media scrum. And then when the player finished talking, they'll walk the player away from us. And what that does is that sets kind of a vibe of, hey, I got to go talk to them. You know, we're dehumanized at that point. And so you're not able to formulate those relationships, or it makes it that much difficult, because me personally, I'm going to do my job. I'm going to get what I need to get, regardless if I got to go around or not. But it makes the job that much more difficult if you can't form the relationships in the context of way you're used to doing so. And then that hurts your coverage as well. Because you don't, you know, when I was in Portland, man, I find out about a family member, a player's family member that's going through some things and some things that's really bothering them. And that player may be struggling for like 10 games. Well, then you got a better context of what that player is going through, and you can articulate that more so better in a story and get people to understand why this player is going through what he's going through. You can't do that here, or where it's much more difficult to do that here because of the fence or the boundaries that they want to set between media and players. I think they want to do it also as well to try to eliminate sources. You know, make sure you get too many connections, and so you won't do things against them. But I think that harms the team more so than it helps, because, you know, if you have a relationship like last year, you know, I ripped Kyrie on a couple of stories. You know, I would rip Kevin Love on a couple of stories, and that wasn't to say I was doing that just because I wouldn't get access, but I would rip them based on their performances, based on how they were handling their professionalism, you know, on the job force. But if I knew them a little better, if I'd known, I put Kevin Love out there. I've known Kevin Love for a while. You know, him and his family was in Portland. It is in Portland, so I knew Kevin Love for a while, but I'm just using it for example. But if you know these players and get to know them, you have a better understanding and a better know-how of how to cover and how to write, how to articulate that to the audience. So that's why I think it harms the media folks, especially the ones that cover them on every day. I think it harms the whole coverage more so than it helps.
I agree with you, and I think most good journalists would agree with you that oftentimes when PR staffs restrict access, it ends up hurting them catastrophically in the coverage, thus not fulfilling what they're ultimately trying to do. You know, Chris, I'm based in New York, so obviously I know a lot of the Knicks beat writers.
No doubt.
And I wonder, in your travels around the league, what organizations have you found where, you know, maybe the Knicks will be one, because most of the beat writers here would say this, but when you have gone to other opposing markets, are there any organizations where you sort of take note, like, wow, that access is really restrictive, or man, that would be a tough team to cover on a day-to-day basis because these guys are not getting time with the players?
Yeah, well, that's New York, Oklahoma City, San Antonio to an extent. But mainly Oklahoma City stood out. You know, I think about that that Grantland piece last year.
Brian Curtis, great piece.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Lee has a great relationship with Kevin Durant. And that's a situation that if that was LeBron, put the story out there, but Michael Lee has a great relationship with Kevin Durant, you know, from his hometown. And so I guess Durant fulfilled his media scrum obligations and were walking out to the court. Michael Lee went over there to follow him or talk with him. And so they're walking on to the court, and a PR guy chases them down and tells Mike, hey, did you get enough over there? And Mike's like, what's going on? Like that's unnecessary.
Agreed.
That's really unnecessary. If Durant and Mike have a relationship and Durant's willing to talk, he's a man. First of all, he's a man. You know, let him make his decision. You know, let him, you know, hold that weight. And so that was, you know, you see things like that or you hear things like that. That's really discouraging because, look, me, I consider myself an aggressive reporter, and there are a lot of those out there. I'm going to get my scoop somehow. I'm going to get my story somehow. I'm going to get my exclusive somehow. So if I got to work around you, maneuver, or whatever, I'm going to get it. And at the end of the day, when I do get it, and you've been trying to restrict me all this time, it's definitely not going to come out the way that you intended because you're trying to block my access. So if you can work with me and work with some of the guys that's really trying to do a job, because we're not out here trying to hurt these players. We're not trying to damage their reputations. We're not trying to do any of that. But sometimes we see opportunities like me. I feel like I'm a creative reporter. I'm not going to ask all of my creative questions out there in the scrum and give everybody else the same so they can eat off of my plate. That's not happening. You got a lot of reporters that come to the scrum. They have no intentions of asking a question, no intentions of participating whatsoever. But as soon as you ask an interesting question that nobody else is going to ask, what's happening then? Everybody's tweeting it out. Everybody's getting it out. Everybody's eating out of your plate. So this is what happens. So if LeBron's in the scrum and I got something very, very interesting that I know is going to be a good story, I pull LeBron to the side and be like, hey, Bron, please give a brother 5 minutes. And he'll let me, ask him what it's about. And I tell him, nine times out of 10, he'll give me that time. And then what happens is it goes from people not eating off my plate to now I got the whole scoop, the whole exclusive to myself. Now, if you want a piece of that, now you got a link to me instead of it being spread around from about 20 different publications. So that's the reason, too, that it's important that, especially for a lot of local guys that cover the team every day, to make sure they get their exclusives every now and then. Because, man, I'm not about trying to help everybody else eat. You know what I mean? I got my own agenda, my own, you cover this business, man. You know how jobs are just, getting cut from people left and right, man. Yep. And so it's really important that you stand out. And you're not going to stand out if the system is designed for everybody to get the same quotes.
Chris, how do you weigh or judge when national reporters, either from print or digital or broadcast, come to Cleveland and are trying to get really good access with a LeBron or Kyrie or Kevin Love? Do you see them as competitors, or are they a different breed because they're writing or broadcasting for a national audience, and you ultimately, at least firsthand, have to take care of your local audience on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, no doubt. I look at it. I don't look at them. Oh, they're competitors, first and foremost. They're definitely competitors. When they come in, yes, I understand they have a job to do. And if if one day I become a national guy, I will hope that I will get that same access, that when I step into town, I can get those exclusives because I have a certain, I'm on deadline. I have a certain amount of days to get this job done. But I will say this, is that I don't look at it like, they have a national audience and I don't. When I took the job, based off of this is a national audience.
I agree.
Everybody is looking at LeBron, Kyrie, Kevin Love, the whole homecoming, or coming back home and trying to do something special. So, definitely we're looking out, and I want those guys to get that access because it's important. I mean, but there are a lot of times, man, like LeBron, he doesn't grant access to everybody. You come in town, he doesn't care if you're national or not. He doesn't grant access to everybody. So a lot of times national guys do come and all they can work with is just the quotes from the scrum. Kyrie's a little, you can get Kyrie, a national guy could probably come in and get Kyrie and Kevin, but coming in and getting Bron, you got to have some type of relationship with them to come in and get that. And that's something that the Cavs PR staff, they don't have control over that. You got to go through probably LeBron's people to try to orchestrate that.
I want to ask you a question, Chris. We're eventually going to get to, and I referenced this at the top, your the piece that you recently wrote about your experiences in Portland, getting what I would consider racially profiled and then ultimately being exonerated after what looked like, quite frankly, some BS charges that were thrown to you. But as a prelude to that, I want to ask you a couple questions about race and reporting in the NBA. It strikes me that and again, I'm sure there are statistics out there that probably can back this up, But in terms of the major sports, it strikes me that the NBA is the league with the highest percentage of reporters of color. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
Okay, no doubt. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's editors intentionally placing people of color in a league made up primarily of people of color? Or do you think there's another reason for that?
Rich, I don't know, man, off the top of my head, I really don't know what the underlying theme is for why that is the case. I do know before I was covering the league, you know, I was brought up with Dwight James, who's a longtime columnist in Portland.
Right.
Kerry Eggers, a longtime columnist in Portland, Oregon. And so they helped me understand, like, when, because I'm still new in the game. I'm 5 years, you know, in on the NBA beat. 6 years, I'm sorry. And I always gravitated towards people who've been there, who's covering it to the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And one thing that was made aware to me is that, you know, a lot of people didn't want to cover the NBA back in the early 90s. It wasn't until Jordan really got to his peak of, you know, winning probably his even the second three-peat. That's when the NBA became pretty much popular. Because a lot of people didn't want to go. And so you had a lot of the, you know, the people of color taking on those beats because nobody else wanted to do so. Now the NBA is more popular, but still night and I still think it's night and day, and I ain't got the stats to back this up, but I still think it's night and day to the NFL.
Right.
And you still got, you know, African Americans still dominating that league, but you can't tell by the media coverage or the you know, the people that's covering the team. It doesn't equate to that.
Right.
And I think there is, you know, I don't know what the problem is. I don't know if it's an editor issue. I don't know what they're looking for, but definitely it's something that needs to be looked into. And it's something, you know, I'm a part of NABJ. And that's something that we've always talked about over the last couple of years. There's definitely not a shortage of African-Americans or other people of color, or even females for that matter, that they're trying to get in there. They want to. Why they haven't, you know, been shown the door? To get in, that is. I really can't tell you, Rich, but it's definitely something puzzling. It's definitely something that needs to be brought up.
Do you think? Do you think in terms of reporters of color in the league, are there any advantages or disadvantages to being a reporter of color in the league, in a league primarily made up of African American players?
Yeah, you know, there's no doubt there is. Look, like I said, the access was so great for me in Portland is that I got to know these players. And in getting to know these players, you see that, hey, and first of all, yeah, I'm 34. So when I started, I was, 28?
Right.
And so I'm still
age.
Still around.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I can relate to them. I was, you know, brought up the same way as a lot of these guys, some of the same rough neighborhoods and same obstacles. And I found that for me, in my stories, you know, I'm able to tell so much revealing graphic stories to where I feel like I got a better picture or I got a better feel on what this player is talking about because, you know, I came up in a similar fashion. And that definitely has helped me, and that definitely has helped my coverage. And I think that was one of the reasons why I was able to kind of move up so fast and ultimately get the beat that I'm covering now, is because the way that I can relate. And but everybody doesn't use that to their advantage. And I think it's still all about people person. If you're a people person, Woj, one of my guys, man, that's my guy. You know, he wasn't raised like a lot of these players.
Right.
But, you know, he got the ear of the players. He's a people person. You go talk to Woj, Woj can have a conversation with you. You can talk back and forth, chit-chat. And that's the one thing that separates reporters as well. It's all about asking questions. Sometimes it's about when to ask a certain question. If you got a pertinent question, don't ask it first. Maybe ask it third or your fourth question. Work it in. And it's all about relationships. How can you, you know, can we talk? Can we have a similar, you know, kind of conversation? You know, every time we talk off the record, it doesn't have to be about something I'm trying to get from you. Let's just chat. Let's just BS for a minute. And that helps you. And so, yes, it is. For me personally, yes, I have seen it as a benefit, my race, my background, and helping me, you know, have coverage. But also, I think I can just relate. You know, I think I can just talk to anybody and have a conversation. And I think that goes a long way as well.
That's interesting, because that so what that says is that if you're, let's say, some 55-year-old white dude who happens to be a really good person who listens, good BS person, really interested in whatever the players are doing, even if that player is 25 years younger, that player's black, the reporter's white, you're saying the reporter still can have a good rapport and get some good stuff if the player believes the reporter's really interested in him.
No doubt whatsoever. It's all about doing your research and finding out what this player is about, what they come from, where their obstacles. So that way, when you come to have a conversation, it can gel. It can go smoothly. You know what I mean? But when players, I see so many reporters, man, they go up to a player, I've never even spoke to him before, just come up and ask them a question that, you know, that the player's mom wouldn't even ask him. I'm like, that's not going to get you anywhere. You know what I mean? If anything, the player is going to remember your face forever. He's not going to give you anything. So it's all about your approach, man. It's all about how you talk and how you maneuver. And it's not that you're being slick and trying to be calm with it. But at the same time, man, these players are people. They're human beings. I mean, you got to look at them like that. You know, talk to them like you would talk to your brother, you know, or your sister, and just have a conversation, communicate. It's all about building relationships and knowing how to conversate. A lot of reporters don't know how to talk. They don't know how to communicate. They just know how to ask. And sometimes you just got to listen. And that's the best way.
Very good advice. All right, let's take a break with Chris Haynes, pay some bills. We'll be back right after this. So how did your fantasy football team do this year? Season-long leagues are history for another year, but on FanDuel, you can play for cash all the way up to the Super Bowl. You can also start a listener league to compete with your friends. Now when you play on FanDuel.com with our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, your first tournament is risk-free. That's any contest offered on FanDuel at up to $10. If you win, you keep the money. If you lose, they will refund your account. FanDuel is the best place to play one-week fantasy football. Building a team is easy and fun. Just pick your players and stay under the salary cap. Entry fees start at just $1, so there's a league for everyone. You can also play basketball and hockey on FanDuel. That means you can play fantasy sports for cash on almost any night of the week. Think you know fantasy football or fantasy baseball, fantasy basketball? Come prove it at FanDuel.com. To get started, go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use our code MEDIA and sign up now. Here's an offer. If you enter a league and you don't win, FanDuel will refund your money. That's any contest you want, up to $10. You can sign up on FanDuel.com using my code MEDIA, then make a deposit. Choose your league. If you don't win, you'll get that money right back in your FanDuel account. The only way to get this no-lose offer is to go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone, and use my code MEDIA. FanDuel.com, where it can finally pay to be a fan. That's FanDuel.com. Try it out today. All right, back with Chris Haynes, the Cavs beat reporter, NBA insider for Cleveland.com and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Chris, before we get to the column that you wrote a couple days ago, you're from Fresno, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Did you go to school out in California or somewhere else?
No, I went to college, that is.
College, that is, yeah.
Yeah, well, I played basketball at Fresno Pacific University and graduated at Fresno State University.
Okay. Was your dream job then to like cover the Lakers, or I don't know if anybody's dream job is to cover the Clippers until recently, but were you hoping to be California based, or did you want to get out of California and see the rest of the country?
No, I wanted to get out of California. I've never, you know, except for traveling with my college team, but I've never on my own really ventured outside of California. And most of the time I never really ventured outside of Fresno. It was just a turning point in my life where I felt I needed to do something and get away. And I didn't want to get away too far. You know, I got me and my wife, we have four daughters.
Wow.
So we wanted to go somewhere where I felt I had an opportunity to cover a team, to cover a league, but at the same time, we're in a nice flight distance and a pretty decent drive of returning home if we get homesick. And so we picked Portland, Oregon. You know, we picked Portland, Oregon, and we just went out there, man. And I got my start, you know, with Slam Magazine. I called them and emailed them constantly, saying, hey, man, you know, you got room for me? You know, I didn't get paid in anything. And they say, yeah, we can put you on, but you got to be in the NBA market. And so, you know, that's how we went to Portland, and Slam got me credentialed. So for the first year, I worked for nothing, worked for free. But I was breaking stories and coming up with these exclusive, pretty nice exclusive features through Slam, and kind of built up my name to when Comcast Sportsnet opened up, because they didn't have a beat writer position at the time. So when they opened up, you know, I applied for the job and got it. And that's how that happened.
Nice. Well, it's a lot of hustle though, man, working for free. I like that. Eventually it landed good for you. You just mentioned you have four daughters. I didn't know that. So you are, you're on the road at least 40 weeks a year. And then the playoffs, obviously you're a team that you cover, a team that's, you know, an NBA finals candidate for sure. You don't often talk about this on the podcast, but it's a real factor for those in the media. Is it, how do you, negotiate between raising four daughters and having a job that takes you away a lot of days?
I still don't know. I still don't know. I really don't. When I first got accepted the job for Comcast Sportsnet, and they let me know, hey, you will be traveling every single game. First of all, Rich, I've never traveled in my life. Like I said, aside from probably two or three, you know, flights, you know, by playing college ball, I've never really been to travel. I didn't know anything about traveling, where you know, anything was at. And so it was fun. It was definitely fun. But then as the season goes on, you know, then the bills start piling up, the responsibilities, the obligations that I was sharing with my wife slowly became all on her. And now you're dealing with the whole happy home landscape and trying to deal with that and balance that, you know, even to this day. Look, I'm gonna say this. Even to this day, I still struggle with that. You know, still try to find a balance. And this is the one true fact about this job, this beat job. I don't care what team you cover. Well, mainly basketball and baseball, because they travel so much. Is that most of the guys on the beat, they either divorced or single.
Right.
And that's not, you know, that's not a coincidence. It takes a toll on a family. It really does, because you're not there. You know, it's good that you're supporting for the family, but there's nothing that can duplicate, you know, spending quality time with your kids or with your wife and, you know, missing those precious moments, whether it's a baseball game or a first concert, things like that. You just, you know, I've missed, and I've spoken with people before who've had, you know, a divorce or a couple divorces because of this business, and it's hard. And to this day, they still don't know how the best way was to handle that situation. And so it's tough, man. But I've been fortunate. My wife is, she sticks with me through it all. It's rough, man. That's when kids come up and ask me, how do I deal with that? I tell them, man, I'm still dealing with it.
Yeah, it's a work in progress every day for anybody who's in the sports media on a beat that you got to travel, but I appreciate you addressing that. All right, before we get to your piece, Chris, I want to ask you just one basketball related question or topic. And because we have you, I'd be remiss not to ask you. And that's the look of the Cavs this year. You know, Kyrie's come back. So the team is, I'm sure it's sort of still trying to figure out what it is and who it is. But when you cover these guys on a day-to-day basis, you know that the Eastern Conference, outside of the Cavs, is from 2 to 9, basically. It seems like they're all the same team. What do you make of the Cavs this year in terms of getting back to the finals and having a chance to win?
Well, I mean, the Cavs, they're not going to mention it. No player is going to mention this or say this, but it's championship or bust. You know, this is the year. You know, when they fell so short, you know, definitely injuries played a major part, Kevin Love and Kyrie being out. But this year, usually that second year, LeBron had a similar situation in Miami. That first year, they went through the ups and downs, still close, and then got the next two. This has to be the year. LeBron turned 31 last week. How many years does he have left?
Good question.
And so if he's not, if this game starts to tail off just a little bit, that's a big difference right there. That's a big drop. That's why I say this has to be the year. Even though I don't think that they're the favorites, man, obviously the Golden State Warriors over there, and I still think the San Antonio Spurs are a scary team once they get to the postseason. But I don't think if they can't get it done this year, I think that window drops drastically. I really do. And that's why I think the Cavaliers are, they're taking a lot of practices off this year than they did last year. They're resting guys a lot more, and they're going to start doing that later on. The minute distribution on some of the players, you know, are low compared to previous years. So they're trying to make sure these guys go in, you know, healthy as possible going into the postseason, because obviously that's when it matters. So I really do think it's championship or bust, and I think that's why. Matter of fact, I know that's why LeBron James was so hard on his team earlier in the year, just trying to make sure guys come into the gym and to the arena professional. If it comes to their attire or the way they conduct themselves during practice, or, you know, eliminating hoverboards from coming into the arena, you know, killing all that nonsense.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because he understands his window. This is his legacy. He came back home. You know what I mean? Like, all that whole, he's been forgiven for leaving the first time. And so all is well. But if he could come and bring a championship to this city, a city hasn't had a championship in 52 years, if he can pull that off, he can go down as one of the greatest to ever play this game, period. And probably go down as the greatest, just based off of the story plot.
I agree.
So there's a lot riding on him.
Yeah, no, I know. I agree. I mean, it'd be one of the greatest stories in at least in sports in the last 100 years. Easy. You know, the thing with LeBron is, and there's no way he could have foreseen this in the Cavs as well, they may indeed have a championship team, but they could have never expected what Golden State has become. And that's what's going to be real interesting, because I would not be surprised at all if those teams met again in the title game. And that is I'm sure, Chris, you saw the game that they played on Christmas. That is going to be a tough team to beat four times in seven games.
And who would have thought that the Golden State Warriors had another level to go?
Exactly.
Like, who would have thought that? Like, I think they relish off of that criticism, because if you remember their whole playoff run, each series, the opposing team had a key guy out. And so every time they got past advance, it was like, oh, well, they did it because this guy was out. Anthony Davis was out. Mike Conley was dealing with this, or whoever was the next opponent. And then the finals, Kevin Love was out. Kyrie was out. And they're like, okay, all right. Stephen Curry even stepped this game. I mean, it's ridiculous over there. And that's one thing that frustrated LeBron even more. It's like, we coming into the season lackadaisical, guys aren't looking like they're really taking this seriously. And then that other team on the other side of the coast that just won a championship is picking up to another level like crazy. Like, it's absurd. And that's been weighing on them as well. So definitely, man, it's definitely, you know, I'm hoping to see that, because that, you know, that is just great theater. I'm hoping to see that the finals repeat. And because I think it enhanced the story even more as well. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to, hopefully it gets to that point, but I definitely agree with you, Rich. It's going to be very, very, extremely hard to beat that Golden State Warriors squad four times.
All right. If you're listening to this podcast with Chris Haynes, you probably follow him on Twitter, or you're aware of his work. If not, I will give this to you now, and that's at Chris B. Haynes on Twitter, H-A-Y-N-E-S. You could also go to cleveland.com and check his work out. And the reason I'm pimping right now his Twitter feed is because Chris's pinned tweet right now is the column that he wrote a couple of days ago, which he titled "My Greatest Regret and Why LeBron James on the Tamir Rice case requires more examining." And we talked a little bit about this at the top before I brought Chris in. But now that we have Chris, you know, he wrote a piece that was incredibly personal about him being in Portland and something that happened to him when he walked outside of his house around 11 o'clock. He was talking to his coworkers. Across the street from his house, there was a railroad track. The track was wedged in the middle of two one-way streets. He's basically on the gravel area in this place talking to his colleague. His house is 15, 20 feet away. Police car comes down. They come up to him, and the cop flashes the high beams in his face. Male officer, who's white, steps out of the car, asks him what he's doing on private property. I'll let you read the rest of the story, but it goes into what strikes me as an incredibly clear case of racial profiling. You know, Chris had to deal with a lot of horrible shit that night that one should not have had to deal with. The state of Oregon exonerated Chris Haynes, and you can go read that in his column over this. So that's a quick preamble, Chris, to ask you, this is a personal piece and far away from what you do on a day-to-day basis. So first off, why did you feel compelled to write it when you wrote it?
I felt like, Rich, I felt eventually I would get enough guts or nerves to write it. I thought maybe I would create a personal blog or probably write on my Facebook page just to get it out. That has been weighing on me. It has been haunting me. It was over 2 years since that happened, July 2nd, 2013. And I've always had problems dealing with that. So when these racial profiling, what we consider to be racial profiling murders that have been taking place by the hands of police officers around the country, with each slaying, it disturbed me even further. And the reason being because I felt that when I was exonerated, I felt like I should have sued. I went in with the intentions of suing. I hired an attorney, great attorney, specialized in those sort of cases. And that was my intentions. But then I started talking to people in my inner circle, and they were saying, Chris, man, look, you know, you got a wife and four kids. Your career is on the upswing. You're young, promising. Like, if you do this, this could get out, you know, because, you know, that arrest didn't get out. And another thing that I didn't put in my story, Rich, is that, you know, when you get arrested in certain cities, they got these mugshot websites. And so when I got out around after 3 a.m, my mugshot that I shouldn't have took it in the first place, but that mugshot was on this site. And you know, Rich, when mugshots get out, people don't care. It doesn't matter what case or what you did. You know what I mean? Because that's the image. So they see a mugshot, you automatically did something wrong. And so I had to like pay that service to get that mugshot off. You know, that's this little extra little thing. But anyways, bringing it back to why I wrote about LeBron is getting criticized by a lot of black activists, you know, even some black reporters I've seen out there for not taking a stand on the Tamir Rice case that's here right in his backyard of Cleveland. And although I would say I was surprised by LeBron saying he had no comment or that he wasn't educated on the situation, I felt like, hey, I can't call him out on it because when I had the opportunity to sue, I didn't. I was afraid that things would get out, that the situation would get out, and it would ruin my image, and it would have a connection with my company, Comcast Sportsnet, at the time. My company said they would stand by me because I told them my intentions of filing a lawsuit. But you never know what would happen if it gets out, if things get ugly and things get nasty. So that's why I felt that I need to write that story at that time. And that's why I tied it into LeBron and how he handled the Tamir Rice incident.
Chris, did you, prior to writing this story, I'm guessing, did you talk to an editor or did you talk to your editors at the outlet and say, listen, this is something I want to do? Because I don't know if they realize this, but that piece went viral. I don't know what the traffic is on it, but I'm guarantee it's huge. So if nothing else, you probably would have wanted to let them know what was coming and how, when you told them that this was your idea and you wanted to do this, what were your boss's reaction?
Well, Rich, I think it's huge, big reason because of you. I appreciate you for spreading the word and getting it out there. When I told my editor, you know, first he wanted to see where this was coming from. And he was like, whoa. And you know, tell you the truth, my editor is pretty cool. I actually told him about the incident a couple months ago. And so he knew about it. And so when I told him, hey, man, LeBron's going through this and I got a take on it. You know, I'm the only African-American person that covers this team on a daily basis. I felt I had an obligation to weigh in. And I told him where I wanted to go with it. And so he listened. We talked back and forth about it. And he said, okay, go with it. Let's see what it looks like. And so I wrote it. You know, I still didn't know if he was going to accept it. So I wrote it. the night before on December 31st, and on New Year's morning, he called me back. He said, "This is good. Let's go." And from that moment, man, when he said that, it was like, man, I couldn't believe it, because everything that I did not want to happen over 2 years ago, I knew it was going to happen now. Like, it was going to get out. And people were going to take us, feel a certain way about it. And I also want to make this clear as well. You know, we were talking about, you know, the police force and police officers. I had no ill wills toward police officers. You know, after that incident in Portland, I joined this gang prevention meeting sessions that work with, it's where community leaders and activists in the neighborhood work with local police enforcement to try to solve how we can interact better, or how can we, you know, just police better, you know, some of the people of color in Portland. And so, I have no ill will, no problems whatsoever with police force. They have a very difficult job to do. But with this officer in particular, I had a huge issue with the way I was handled, with the way I was dealt, because I felt like it shouldn't have got to that point. I'm right across the street from my house. It's the second day that I moved in my home. I'm from California. I don't know anything about the Max Railroad line. All I knew is that when I talk on the phone, Rich, I pace back and forth.
Right.
And so I felt like I just wanted to go outside, pace, talk on the phone, walk on the gravel area that's on the side of the tracks, that's about 8 feet wide. I'm just pacing back and forth. And he comes over, flashes the beams on my face, asking me for ID, asking me to get on the curb. And I'm telling the officer, my house is right there. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? And that's why in the story. And Rich, this is another thing. In the story, Rich, when I was writing the story, I mean, I looked at the police report that the officer filed for the first time. I've never looked at it. And I'm looking at the words he's saying. He's talking about Chris is a large man or something like that. He's in pretty good shape. And his actions were similar to other guys who either fought the cops or ran away from the cops. And so I had to do what I had to do. And so I put those quotes of his report just to paint the picture of what this officer was thinking about me in the first place. Because obviously I ain't thinking about fighting nobody, running away. And he's constantly during the whole time asking me, well, do you have any warrants? Do you have any warrants? And I'm like, officer, man, I don't know what you think I am. I know I'm wearing a tank top, black shorts, whatever you think a criminal looks like. I'm not that guy. And so I just had a problem with that officer in particular, man. And I had plans of putting his name in the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was told not to. By my editor. And so that's the reason, man. That's the reason why I felt compelled to write the whole thing.
How long did the piece take you to write?
Babe, how long did it take me to write the story? It didn't take that long, Rich. It probably took hour 20, maybe, you know, because I remember it so vividly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I remember it so vividly. So I'm just writing it down, and I would say the longest part of the whole process was just going back and reading the police report that he filed on me, and going back and reading the transcripts from our court hearing. And another thing, Rich, I didn't put this in the piece as well. A couple things I didn't put in the piece is that there's a part where my wife, she doesn't know that I'm being arrested outside. She doesn't know what's going on. All she knows is I'm on the phone. So she's actually, remember, this is the second day we're in my home.
Right.
She's actually drilling up holes in the wall to put up photos up on the wall. And so when Peter finally gets a hold to her and tells her, hey, something's going on with Chris outside, she runs outside with the drill in her hand. And then thankfully she thinks in her head, like, let me put this drill down. I don't want it to seem like, you know what I mean? We don't want another Tamir Rice on our hands over here. This before Tamir. So I'm thankful she had to know it all to think that. And then she came out there and addressed the cop. And another thing was this, Rich. I felt like, look, man, I really felt and believed that I was racially profiled. It was a bad neighborhood that I was living in, and that I didn't know at the time. That still doesn't mean he should have did what he should have did. I was never given the opportunity. He never came over and said, hey, you're trespassing or you're interfering with public transportation. Can you please move over cross the street to your house and continue your phone conversation. That would have been the extent. And I've seen officers drive up and down that street, because I've lived in that house, that same house, probably a year and a half, you know, after that incident. And I've never seen, I've seen people walk up and down that, you know, down that track. I've never seen any cops coming and harassing them about it. You know, it was just some straight bull, man. But I'm glad I was exonerated, and I didn't even go into court, Rich, with an attorney. I represented myself. I felt like, look, man, if I can't tell my story and tell it how it really happened, and this judge don't see, you know, who was really done wrong here, then, you know, I don't know what to say. You know, the officer, he had his attorney right there. And the trial lasted about 30 minutes, man. And I've seen some people commenting, talking about, hey, the trial can't last up. It can't last 30 minutes. The trial lasts about 30 minutes, maybe a little longer, but 30 minutes. Me, myself, I had Peter as a witness to come and say his piece. The officer had him and his attorney. And I was exonerated free within 30 minutes.
Chris, as horrible as that incident was, what kind of satisfaction did you get, if nothing else, from the fact hearing that judge say, we're throwing these charges out, your record is clean?
You know what, Rich? I didn't get much satisfaction from that, because I really felt like justice had to be done.
Right.
Like, it had to be. Like, how can you arrest somebody? How can you make the claim that I'm interfering with public transportation when I'm walking along the gravel area? Obviously, Rich, if I seen the max line coming, I would have moved away. But there was no, justice had to be done. So I didn't go in there thinking that, you know, I didn't go in there thinking that, you know, it was up in the air. I felt like, man, if this justice system is right, and it doesn't always work for everybody, but I felt like this was just so blatantly wrong that it had to work in my favor. So that wasn't the hard part. So that wasn't, you know, I didn't get a big relief after that. My next thing was, okay, now I found this lawsuit. Now that's where I'm going with this. And then when people start telling me, you know, ramifications, what can come about that, the tide, do you think your company's going to stick by, blah, 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 you know, I started listening to them. My wife, she was adamant, filed a suit. Don't let this happen. And then my lawyer, I wrote this in a story. He said, look, Chris, you back out of this. A person of your stature who's a, you know, considered a local celebrity in this town, you back out, and other people out there, the regular people, they won't stand a chance if the same type of situation came up. And that always stuck with me. So I felt like my satisfaction, Rich, came from that story I published. Because the overwhelming support that I got, man, it was ridiculous, man. You know, really, real talk, Rich, I was crying, man. I was a grown man crying. Because I got so much support, man. It was so much love for people that I admire, people I never heard about, heard from. I'm getting emails, texts. Man, it's just been overwhelming, man. And I felt a big relief just let off of me, man. I felt a huge relief off of me, off of that. Off of letting that story be told, man. And that was my big moment where I felt like, you know, somehow justice was done. I just felt real good about it.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not a perfect ending, and it's never going to be a perfect ending. But obviously, I speak for a lot of people when we're glad you wrote it, glad to have read it. The last thing I want to end with, Chris, and I think, you know, the piece was so big and got so much attention. I do want to ask you, in the midst of covering the Cavs, who you heard from on that team, who you heard from in the organization, who read that piece. And obviously, the big question is, did you hear from LeBron about it?
No, I didn't. I didn't hear from LeBron about it. From the organization, yeah, the PR staff, they came and they told me what, you know, how great of a story it was and how they touched him. And, you know, we talked about the incident. Of course, my great colleagues, man, the people, you know, Dave McMenamin from ESPN, Jason Lawyer, Akron Beacon Journal, my partner Joe Vard with Cleveland.com, man, they all just, you know, just praised me. Chris Fedor, Cleveland.com, all just praised me, and, you know, just told me how big of, you know, it was to get that out there, man. Portland, Coach Terry Stotts reached out to me, sent me an email. Coach Nate Tibbetts, the assistant coach for Blazers, sent me an email. Of course, John Canzano down there. I went on this show yesterday down there in Portland, Thomas, the Oregonian. He reached out to me. That was pretty, you know, we talking about, you talking about NBA personnel. That was pretty much the extent.
Right.
David Griffin, the GM for the Cavs, he definitely came up.
That's cool. I saw Holly Robinson Pete reached out, which I thought was pretty cool too.
Oh man, it was crazy, man. Holly Robinson Pete, Reggie Miller, Rachel Nichols. I mean, the list goes, man. My colleagues, man. That was crazy. I don't want to keep naming people because I don't want to leave people out. It was a whole flock of people, man. And I didn't think it would go like that. You know, obviously I felt relieved, and first of all, I felt relieved just getting my story out. You know, because I felt like, okay, in some way, shape, or form, I'm making amends off of what I didn't do over 2 years ago. So that was first and foremost. Then when everybody just started, I didn't think it would go like that. I really didn't. I didn't. I was surprised. I was humbled. I was flattered. My emotions were just filled up all over the place, man. And I want to tell them right now, you know, on the show, man, thank you. Everybody who reached out, gave me support. I saw each and every tweet. My mind, I was showing my wife, even the fans, the Twitter followers, everybody. I seen each and every tweet. If you tweeted at me, and my Twitter line was flooded. If you tweeted at me, I saw it. And I appreciate it from the bottom of my heart. And Rich, can I drop one more thing real quick?
Of course.
I want to address something real quick. There were a few people that tweeted at me, well, Chris, if you would have just gave them your ID from the get-go, none of this would have happened. But let me address that. My experiences with police officers, and I'm pretty sure it's like this with a lot of other African-American or people of color, it's not a pleasant one. So when I'm in front of my house talking on the phone about business, and a cop comes and flashes their light in my face, high beam in my face, asking me what I'm doing here, to which I explain, you know, I'm just on the phone. My house is right there. Let me see your ID. I'm a reporter. I'm going to ask why. Why, sir? What did I do? Why are you asking my ID? Give me your ID. Do you got any warrants? So, no, I wasn't being defiant, but definitely I was asking questions. And then when I did give him my ID, then he asked me to sit on the curb. Now, it's like, first of all, at that time, I know I'm being racially profiled, and now I'm getting treated like a criminal now. Why, I got to sit on the curb? For what? For what, sir? What harm am I to you right now? So could I have gave him my ID and things ended up differently? I still would have been racially profiled. He still came up there because he had a preconceived notion of who I was. So, no. I mean, you got to walk in somebody else's shoes to experience the type of experience they had prior to understand why people do the things they do now. I was not defiant. No, anytime did I cuss. I did not curse. And if the Portland Police Force brings up video, is there a video of it, they will see I did not curse at all to that man, to that officer at all. But I was asking questions because I felt I had the right to do so right in front of my own house. So that's why I didn't give him my ID from the get-go. Because I want to know why you're coming at me like this, why I'm getting treated like this.
Well, Chris, I appreciate you explaining that. And I would say the reason why I think it touched a nerve with everybody is because I think people read it as authentic. We live in a world where there's a lot of bullshit thrown out there. And I think people read your piece, regardless of what color they are. And they read this as, this is an authentic, honest piece from a guy who was at that time pretty much done wrong. So I appreciate you. I definitely appreciate you writing it. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Chris Haynes is the Cavs beat reporter and NBA insider for Cleveland.com and the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He's if you're an NBA fan, he's a must follow. He covers essentially the most important team in the league, or one of the two most important teams in the league. And you can read his stuff online, and you certainly should follow him on Twitter if you're on Twitter at Chris B. Haynes, HAYNES. Chris, I really appreciate the honesty and the time. I want to thank you for coming on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and continued success out there in Cleveland.
I want to say, like, from the bottom of my heart, man, thank you. I've seen how you were spreading the word, man. I really do appreciate that, Rich. Honest to God, truth, and man, take care. Anytime you need me, let me know.
You got it. It was my pleasure, Chris. Thanks so much.
Take care.
All right, it's wild card weekend in the NFL, and these four games are going to be huge, exciting, draw fantastic numbers. But you just don't have to watch it on television. SeatGeek is the best way to find a ticket in Houston, Cincinnati, Minnesota, or Washington. And now when you download the app and use our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, you get $20 back. Here's how it works. Download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android, then enter the code MEDIA. And when you make your first purchase, SeatGeek will send you $20 via check or PayPal. SeatGeek pulls all the ticket buying and selling options from the other ticket sites into one place to save time. It's like a kayak for tickets. SeatGeek also knows the fair market value of every ticket. They use that information to show you the best deals and help you find underpriced seats. If you have tickets you can't use, SeatGeek will also help you quickly sell them to another fan. You don't like those fees at the end, SeatGeek has the lowest fees of any ticket site out there. Always shows you the full price up front. So to redeem your promo code and get your $20 back, download the free SeatGeek app today. Enter promo code MEDIA in the app. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first SeatGeek purchase. For the NFL's Wild Card Weekend, college football's title game, the best concerts, use the SeatGeek app and our code MEDIA, M-E-D-I-A, to get $20 back. The MMQB podcast gets you ready for the Wild Card Weekend with football writers Robert Klemko, Andy Benoit, and now Robert Mays, formerly of the Grantland NFL podcast. They've also done two special episodes, a Star Wars special with Chris Conley of the Chiefs, and a three-city tour of NFL teams, which could be moving to Los Angeles. That's the MMQB podcast. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher, or at si.com/podcasts. All right, back in the studio with Alan Kim after Chris Haynes' interview. That was excellent. That is easily one of the best podcasts I've done. Chris is not as famous as, if you want to use that word famous, as some of the other people I've had, or certainly at least well-known, because this show has had a lot of national people on television, but that was excellent. I mean, that is what you want as a podcast guest: honesty, transparency, passion. If you're a young person who wants to get in the business, or you're sort of starting out, he gave you a lot of good advice just in terms of how to approach athletes and how to think about stuff. But Alan, you know, obviously the most poignant stuff is just Chris talking about his experience and what went down in Portland. And I don't know about you, but I mean, I thought I heard through his voice that he was, I don't want to say he was crying, but he was really emotional. And you could, in the midst of telling the story, you could hear his emotion continuing to come out, and he got more animated. It was almost as if he was reliving what happened to him as he was describing his answer. At least I thought so.
Yeah. It's almost like, I don't know if it like touched the nerve, but like, obviously it was a big part of his life. This impacted him. And
he has a lot of regret as to obviously not filing a civil suit at the time.
Oh, is that something he would consider in the future? That's like,
I don't know the statute of limitations. My guess is that he wrote the, I think if you take the podcast, I think he said he wrote the piece, and that's sort of where, you know, that for him, not that it ever sort of makes up for what he felt, but I think for him, that's maybe the, how do I phrase it? That's sort of the circle sort of complete. Like, that's the catharsis. He got that piece out.
Yeah.
Everybody now knows of his experience. He mentioned it. He didn't mention the cop who was, part of that, incident, but it was interesting. The other thing with Chris too, is that I'm really fascinated by how accessible LeBron James seems to be for a superstar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chris clearly has a really good relationship with him, but he went out of his way even to talk about when the Cavs were not, you know, when the reporters had issues with the Cavs last year, that even above all that, LeBron still seemed to be totally like understanding of his role as a superstar. I've always said this. I think LeBron is great. I think ever since he kind of turned his image around after the decision stuff, he's been in my lifetime about as good a superstar with the press as I've ever seen.
Yeah, and he was telling about how LeBron was set up before. He knows where to go, like, for the reporters. He knows his role. And, like, yeah, I thought he was, like, very smart about that.
That's impressive. The other thing, too, at least on a basketball term, was did you hear Chris say that he thought the window was 1 year? That's really interesting. I think that Chris Haynes knows more about the Cavs than me and you will ever know. But that stunned me, because that is not something I would have thought. If nothing else, I would have thought a 2 to 3 year window, just because of Kyrie's age and Kevin Love's age and Thompson's age.
They have some young pieces, and I'm with you. I don't think it's 1 year. I think it's about 3 years is like the widest part of this window. I mean,
31 LeBron, but it probably feels a little bit older because of all the miles on his legs. But 31 is still, I mean, you know, Jordan won championships at that age. That's not ancient.
Well, also, we had Lee on Maggie's podcast like a couple weeks ago, and he mentioned that he could see LeBron taking on more of an elder statesman role where he's maybe playing more in the post. He's playing like second or third to Kyrie.
So the ball doesn't go through him all the time, basically. He's like a power forward you got to get the ball to kind of stuff?
It would play him out of the post. He'd use his, you know, passing abilities, like his court vision, and he would set other people, and he wouldn't be the first option anymore. He'd be number two or three.
I'll say this, man. LeBron James is a second option. Even an older LeBron James would be awesome because you're right. He's one of the best passing forwards or guards you'll ever see. That's interesting. And maybe that saves a little bit of the wear and tear of his body because he's played. Look how many minutes he's played since he's been 18.
Yeah.
I mean, at a certain point, and including playoffs, including Olympics, at a certain point.
I mean, look at Kobe now.
Look at Kobe now. Yeah, I mean, when the cliff falls, it falls. Yeah. But I still think LeBron's a little ways away from that, but that Golden State team is scary just because their best players are young and probably still have a little bit of upside.
Yeah.
All right. We thank Chris Haynes. That was excellent. I really appreciate him coming on, and I don't know if enjoyed is the right word because some of the stuff he's talking about was serious, but I really respected what he had to say.
Also, you mentioned at the top, like the advice he gave was just phenomenal.
Excellent. Yeah. Really, I mean, I hope other people in the NBA listen. That guy should be on your podcast if you are, if you're an NBA fan or a podcaster, et cetera. Reach out to him. Nice guy. Totally accepted this offer pretty quick, and I imagine he would do the same for you. All right. Our thanks to our guest. My thanks to producer Alan Kim. Want to thank the Dan Bloom, who is the executive producer of all our podcasts. Ben Eagle, who's the in-house head at Sports Illustrated. Who else do I got to thank? Ryan Hunt and Paul Fichtenbaum for their continued support of these podcasts. Thank you for listening to the SI Media podcast. Last couple of weeks, the numbers have gone up, so I really appreciate it. From Gus Johnson to Jay Billis to Bob McKenzie, and I hope the Chris Haynes podcast you guys like. We got some people coming up. PFT commentator will be coming up in the next week or two. I have a pretty good line on Troy Aikman of Fox, so I think that will happen. And Gab Marcotti, who I've been promoting forever, the excellent soccer writer for ESPN as well as other global publications, he'll definitely be on. I just got to figure out with him a date. Maybe that'll be February. But those are the next couple. I'm fairly convinced Aikman, or I should say I fairly feel good that Aikman will be on in January sometime. And PFT commentator, though, is booked. And that should be pretty funny, the anonymous PFT commentator. All right, for Alan Kim, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.